Hello and welcome to the debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. ISIL militants continue to commit heinous crimes, with one of the latest getting Western countries' attention as a missing American journalist was filmed while being beheaded. How is it possible that ISIL is able to easily use social media without being blocked? And more importantly, how has ISIL been able to grow and gain the power that it has in certain areas of Syria and Iraq? Stay with us as we take a close look at ISIL.
Fierce fighting over the Takba base rages on between the ISIL Takfiri militants and the army in Syria's northern Raqqa province. The militants have waged several massive attacks on the military base in recent days, thanks to heavy airstrikes by the Syrian warplanes and fierce resistance from those inside the Takba base. The ISIL has achieved little. Large numbers of the ISIL Takfiri insurgents have been killed during the clashes with the Syrian forces defending the base. The notorious group appeared out of nowhere last year in Syria in the midst of the foreign-backed war on the nation, as a result of vast sums of money allegedly provided by Syria's regional adversaries, including Saudi Arabia and Qatar. The ISIL turned into the main insurgent group fighting the Syrian government. The ISIL soon began to make encroachments into neighboring Iraq with the aim of what it called the formation of a state consisting of Iraq and the Levant. The militants have captured some swaths of land in Iraq after sneaking into the country, and they are now considered a brutal fighting force, at least in Iraq, committing countless atrocities. They are very well equipped and well funded. Throughout the period, the ISIL has enjoyed what many would consider favorable media coverage from Western news outlets, most notably the BBC. They refuse to refer to the group as a terrorist organization. The ISIL militants can hammer home their messages using social networking websites such as Twitter and Facebook, and also the video sharing website YouTube. They can show their grisly acts graphically as they wish. Even the masked man who beheaded the US journalist James Foley several days ago and sparked horror across the world is said to be a British national with a British accent. As the ISIL continues to cause havoc in Syria and Iraq, the West has mainly stood watching. The US has carried out sporadic airstrikes against the group, but this, Washington admits, is aimed at protecting US troops and diplomats based in Iraq. While some say that the ISIL is nearing its end with the West's intervention looming, many others believe the ISIL was actually designed to change the geostrategic map of the region in favor of those who have supported the group.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, author and historian Dr. Webster Griffin Tarpley out of Washington, and a senior fellow, Hudson Institute, Mr. Richard White. So thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start off with this in Washington with Mr. White. In your perspective, sir, what has made ISIL become the brutal militant group that it is now?
A combination of factors. The fact that the civil war in Syria has tended to polarize around the extremes. The moderates have been losing strength since the fighting began as more and more people were killed. Those surviving became embittered and more inclined to side with the extremists. The extremists were also fortunate in gaining support from some groups in various countries, money, weapons, trained fighters. Then they got lucky and managed to capture some banks and do wealthy. And for a while, they just weren't on anyone's priority list. It's only been in recent months that people come to realize the full extent of the threat.
All right, what about that, Dr. Tarpley? In your perspective, if the United States and its Western and regional allies had not actually supported and created armed groups in Syria to fight against the Syrian government, would we be seeing the same situation as we're witnessing today with ISIL?
Well, I think the fact of the matter is that NATO forces, United States, Britain, and France, are very much behind the creation of ISIS or ISIL. The general idea is that these were fighters that were trained in those NATO camps in Jordan. The money comes from Saudi Arabia. The main money bag seems to be Prince Abdul Rahman Al-Faisal. He's the brother of Saud Al-Faisal, the foreign minister, also the brother of Prince Turkey, the former ambassador here to the United States. The people composing this group have been brought in from Libya at the end of 2011. I'm afraid Ambassador Stevens in Benghazi played a role in that. They were transferred to Turkey and then moved into northern Syria. So it's a well-known group of death squad fanatics, starting off as unemployed men with no future, despair, and so forth, and then given this to do. To sum up this entire argument in one picture, I would urge people to take a look at the Voltaire Network. You can find an article there by my friend Thierry Maison. It's a picture from the spring of 2013, from April 2013, in the area of Idlib in northern Syria. And here we see none other than former Republican presidential candidate John McCain, who is, of course, a top official of the National Endowment for Democracy International Republican Institute operation, sitting down in a strategic consultation with General Salim Idris of the so-called Free Syrian Army, right, the heroes of democracy, pro-Western, and all that. And also sitting there is this guy. We have to give him three names. At that time, he was called al-Badri, and then he became a Baghdadi. He became the head of ISIS, and now I guess he calls himself Caliph Ibrahim. Anyway, that guy, at the moment that McCain sat down with him, was already wanted by the United States for terrorism and killing, $25,000 reward. He was a member of al-Qaeda. He was listed as a member of al-Qaeda on the list of the sanctions that had been imposed vis-a-vis terrorists in Syria. So what this shows is that when we talk about ISIS, we're dealing with the new CIA Arab Legion. In the same way that al-Qaeda, the original one from 1980, was the CIA Arab Legion created with the help of U.S. intelligence, British intelligence, to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. This is now a new version of that, right? Jazzed up for the social media and so forth.
All right, stay with me, Mr. Tarpley. Mr. White, your take on that, of what Mr. Tarpley has just talked about, basically that shows, according to him, collusion by the United States with what is known as ISIS or ISIL or IS of today.
I think that flies in the face of what we're seeing, at least now, with the Secretary of Defense calling it the greatest threat the U.S. has faced since al-Qaeda, with Chairman of the Defense Dempsey saying that we may even have to intervene in Syria in order to defeat the movement. So whatever links there might have been between individuals, and these are allegations, I haven't seen any really proof. It's certainly not U.S. policy at the moment. I mean, the U.S. policy
let me look at that, Mr. Weitz, what you've just said, that it's unlikely because of what we're seeing at the moment. But if we go back, as Mr. Tarpley was just talking about the situation in Afghanistan of the 80s, and we look at the group that the United States actually propped up and supported, some would even say created, to counter the Soviets at the time. And then, of course, we see that same group or an extension of that same group, basically the United States, declaring war on them later on. So it really would not be the first time that we would see a switch in policy out of Washington. Would you say that? Would you agree to that, sir?
Yes, it's sort of the same kind of dilemma we've had now and we had in the past, that you were trying to defeat the Soviet-backed government and you lacked a kind of U.S. European-style liberal democratic opposition. So you sided with what was available, which at the time was the Mujahideen. Now we've got the same problem in Syria. You've got the government, which the U.S. opposes, and you've got ISIL, which the U.S. opposes, and other al-Qaeda groups the U.S. also opposes. So there's no really strong group that you can support. I mean, you often don't have the optimal situation, a panoply of tools to choose from.
But would you usually, in that situation, if you don't have a good option, then would you be behind sending lots of weapons and equipment in a place that you would not be able to have control over, as you've just said? If you see that you do not have a good option, as you call it, then why would you think that the United States and its allies, its Western allies, along with regional allies, continue to send money and weapons to those that were propped up to fight against Damascus?
I would argue, in fact, though, that they accepted the logic of your reasoning, at least until recently, which was the Obama administration was very hesitant about providing weapons or assistance to any of the opposition. Even if they thought they could back the moderate opposition, there was a fear the weapons would either be sold or seized or somehow lost and land in the hands of the extremists.
Okay.
So the Obama administration has been criticized heavily at home and internationally and in the region for not being very involved in the Syrian conflict, for basically staying back and allowing some of the more aggressive regional actors to take the lead.
What about that, Mr. Tarpley, that the Obama administration did not basically do anything in dealing with the situation in Syria, although we have a lot of information saying that actually the Obama administration, along with his Western allies, were actually some of the main entities behind supporting those who were said to be the opposition against the Syrian government?
Well, about a year ago, we had this fake chemical weapons provocation that was cooked up by NATO forces, Saudi Arabia, and others. The goal was to get the United States to bomb Syria. And of course, Obama wisely decided to defer to U.S. and even British public opinion and to the Congress, all opposed to bombing. So Obama was on firm ground with that. The question right now is, if you really think that ISIS is the end of the world, right, if this is the negation of civilization, which in many ways it is, what could you do? You could issue an ultimatum to Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the rest of the Gulf states, the Gulf Cooperation Council, and you could say, boys, stop sending arms and money to ISIS. We also know we have Turkey, a NATO ally. This is right near where ISIS has based itself and where it's emerged. Up until the day before yesterday, that border was open so that the Saudis and the Qataris could send their support in to northern Syria, right, that Raqqa area, and get that aid in. Why didn't the Turks close that border? We also have to remember, Turkey has a huge army. Why don't they just come across, brush ISIS aside, shut this thing down? We were also told that ISIS was the end of the world, but Maliki had to go. But now he's gone, so something at least has happened. However, the most dangerous is the drumbeat among the neocons and among the humanitarian bombers, the Samantha Power Rangers, we might call them. They're saying it's time to bomb Syria. Now, here's the problem. What are the targets supposed to be? I think the lesson of this entire thing is you've got to work with existing governments. Any government is potentially an ally in this kind of a situation against non-state actors who are people who are bringing chaos into the area. I think the most important imperative is to drop this absurd campaign against President Assad of Syria and join with Assad. Help Assad to crush what's left of that rebel insurgency in the ISIS area and all over. And indeed, I would ask my colleague there from the Hudson Institute, if ISIS is, as I think we can agree, the negation of civilization, why not join with Assad? Because we're hearing in the last 48 hours, right, that the key to all this is in Syria. Maybe it is. Why not join with Assad and the legal, recognized government of Syria, UN member state, to crush them? And certainly not to start mission creep where they start bombing Syrian targets that are loyal to Assad.
Okay, well, I'll let you answer that question, way. Mr. White. So what would be your answer to Mr. Tarpley?
The Obama administration has already answered that question. Their argument is they hold Assad responsible for the growth of ISIS. Their argument is that his stubborn refusal to share power and his deliberate strategy of trying to radicalize the opposition, concentrate his forces against the moderates, force the West to face what is a very clever strategy now of having to deal with either two extremes so that they'll choose him as the lesser of the two evils. They say they refuse to do that, but that argument that the U.S. should at least tacitly ally with Assad has been gaining support in Washington, including by one of the former ambassadors of the U.S. to Syria. So it's gaining traction, but it won't be something the Obama administration will explicitly pursue, given the reasons I just gave.
All right, stay with me, Mr. Weitz and Mr. Tarpley. Let's cross over to our Facebook page and see what some of our viewers have been posting.
Those who created Al-Qaeda are the same who created ISIL, and they keep on creating more, so watch out for them. ISIS is an American CIA Mossad creation. They are still being funded by US tax dollars. Iran and Press TV are the sponsors of ISIL. America created the mess in Libya, Iraq, and Syria. This is only a product of a very ill-fated experiment. Of course, US. It wants to enter Syria through bombing ISIS. In fact, those are people living in the West coming to the Middle East to cause death and destruction. The one who beheaded the American journalist probably is a Brit. These all started since Palestine was occupied by the help of Western governments. I see immigrants go to the streets of Western capitals waving ISIL flags and give openly their support to the so-called caliphate or Islamic State.
Mr. Tarpley, your take on some of our viewers' opinions. We look at, we have a whole wide range from blaming Press TV, actually, for what ISIL is doing to many others. But I want to look at, in general, what we see, we have some of the viewers talking about the Western individuals involved in all of this. And I want to look at that, because we know at the situation that started, when it started in Syria, Syrian President Assad and his government continued to say that there were thousands of fighters coming in from these Western countries. And basically that continued to be ignored. And now we see a lot of these Western governments saying that the biggest threat to them right now are these same fighters when they return to their home countries. Why at that point in time was it totally ignored, but now at this point in time it becomes number one priority? At least that's what they're saying.
Well, partly because it's become a political and public relations embarrassment for Obama. Now, that's an opportunity to get something done, right? The CIA and the other intelligence services, they do what they want. They don't ask Obama or any president. So they've been creating this ISIS. This is simply their method of work. But now we've got a situation where there's a public interest in the subject, right? And Obama feels that he has to do something. The question would then be, what? Again, I recommend work with existing governments. The history of all this stuff, though, goes back to this shadowy network inside the U.S. government, right? Rogue network or invisible government. It goes back to people like John Negroponte, U.S. ambassador in Baghdad about 10 years ago. This is when these death squads began to emerge. His disciple was Ambassador Robert Ford, who became then the U.S. ambassador to Syria at precisely the time that death squads emerged. Now, there never was a phase of democratic agitation in Syria that was not accompanied by gunfire. It was there all the time. Remember, there had been violent opposition to the Assad family going back to the 1980s. So there never was this mythical democratic phase. The other thing to say is, there are no moderates in the Syrian opposition. We even see an institutional figure like Fareed Zakaria of CNN pointing out that this is simply an illusion. And indeed, I would go further. If you look at that picture of McCain with Idris, General Idris of the FSA, and Baghdadi, who is now the caliph or calls himself the caliph, you'll see there is no difference. The Free Syrian Army is the same thing on the ground as Nusra, as the Islamic Front, as ISIL, ISIS, or whatever you want to call it, and now the Islamic State. This is all these are all the same people. Okay. They just put on a different hat. If they have to talk to U.S. senator, they'll dress up one way. If they have to go out and talk to some people newly arrived from Chechnya or northern Libya, Cyrenaica, Derna, they'll put on a different getup, right? So it's all the same thing. There are no moderates.
All right, Mr. Weitz, in general, we see with the situation of ISIL that basically when we look at the social media, that seems to be the main medium that they're spreading actually more and more of these terroristic acts that they're showing on the social media. Why is it that we're not seeing it shut down? For example, we continue to see, we saw the beheading actually put on these social media sites, and it's one of the main forms that they get their message across. Why hasn't that been shut down, you think, in your perspective? Okay, it seems like we have unfortunately lost Mr. Weitz. Well, Mr. Tarpley, your take on that. The role in this terrorist group with ISIL and social media. We're seeing a little different take as far as a terrorist group this time around being extremely internet savvy and using the social media. Why aren't they being shut down?
Because there's an interest in not having them shut down. I would point out that the coverage in the U.S. mass media is the glorification of ISIS. Why? They're supermen. They're 10 feet tall. They're so sophisticated. Sophisticated is the most common word, right? They know how to use the social media.
Well, why? Of course, it sounds like that. Why is that? Why is that? Because we only have a minute left, Mr. Tarpley. Why is that the case, that they're portrayed like that in the West?
They've got to build it up. Let me just point out, James Foley, the poor victim we deplore his killing, he went to Libya to essentially do positive publicity for terrorists. He was there when Gaddafi got killed. He was then moved over to the Aleppo area. His troubles began when he wrote an article saying the people of Aleppo don't like the terrorist rebels. The people of Aleppo are getting nostalgic for Assad. And then within a couple of months, he was kidnapped. Maybe they decided to use this poor guy in a different way. You can compare it also to the pro-Al-Qaeda propaganda coming from people like Bernard Lewis and or Michael Scheuer of the CIA Bin Laden unit. They were writing that Bin Laden was a hero, that he was the George Washington of the Arab world and so forth. So this is what the CIA does when they want to build up this ogre, this poobah, and then use that to manipulate public opinion around the world, including the U.S., the Arab world, Europe, and so forth.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Mr. Webster Griffin Tarpley, author and historian out of Washington. And unfortunately, we lost our other guests the last couple of minutes of the program. I'd also like to thank Mr. Richard Weitz, also out of Washington, senior fellow of the Hudson Institute. And as always, viewers, we appreciate you being with us on another debate right here out of our international studios in Tehran. I'm Marzieh Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the crew. Thank you and goodbye.